Good evening, everybody. November 3rd, 2011. And so some, this second I have to adjust some sound on my end here. Okay, very good. All right, November 3rd, 2011, ready to talk. And tonight's main science topic, I'll be continuing going into a little bit more detail on a topic I've been talking. Last week I talked about the Jupiter winds. Actually, that was the October 20th show. And lo and behold, we had a tremendous storm in the northeast and setting records, things like that. I said that there would be some unusual weather activity. And the thing is, these storms tend to be localized. When the energy comes into Earth, it tends to be quite, it tends to come down in columns. And that's why, for example, the northeastern part of the country got labeled. And where I was in the upper Midwest, we had beautiful weather. So when these energy systems come in, first of all, I want to mention that the National Weather Service had no clue. They had no clue that this was coming. And so as it came in and started to settle into the northeast, they were scrambling and saying, oh, goodness, we have a storm upon us, and making announcements. But by that time, people were caught up in this storm. They were far away from where they might have been if they knew a storm was coming. Airlines were completely caught off guard, and they, of all people, should be very tuned to the weather. So, number one, the National Weather Service did not see it coming. And number two, I should mention, there's an expression I have. It's actually the title of one of the chapters in one of my books. It's called, You Can't Predict the Weather If You Don't Know What Causes the Weather. And it's very much the case. I make this point very clear in my weather book, Principia Meteorologia, the physics of sun, earth, weather. I make the point many times that the weather people, what do? To predict the weather? Well, they take past trends. They have a computer full of data, and they say, well, now we have a high pressure cell here, we have a low pressure cell over here, we have a current high level winds of this amount, and et cetera, et cetera. They put all the data into the computer, and the computer goes back and sees what past weather patterns, what they did, and then they say, okay, here's our prediction. So they extrapolate from past events. Well, if you have a big solar wind surge and electrical activity going on, plus an electrical connection with Jupiter, that's not in their computer models. Well, naturally, they're not going to be able to predict. And that's what I say, too. I emphasize the fact that it's the severe weather, that's the quickly occurring severe weather that the National Weather Service can't handle. Their computer models have no knowledge of this. And so, sure, they're going to be caught off guard. I was in, there was a huge F1 tornado that came through Minnesota and into Wisconsin, completely leveled a town there, killing many people and causing tremendous devastation, completely out of a clear blue sky, and the National Weather Service didn't even know about it until the whole storm was over. And that's the kind of thing that I am kind of pound on here, is that, sure, if today is 70 degrees and the next week is going to be 70 degrees and everything is fine and there's gentle breezes and nothing going on, sure they can predict the weather. But it's that extreme weather coming in on electrical conditions, electrical attachments to other planets, possibly comets, possibly the lunar activity where the new moon, 2 days after the new moon, the moon moves out of the alignment between Earth and the sun, and all of a sudden the solar wind comes pounding in and triggers some activity on Earth. So these are the conditions that can trigger Earth weather, severe Earth weather. Well, in this past week, we had the Jupiter connection. The October 28th and 29th was right in that, between those 2 days when the Jupiter superior conjunction occurred. That's where Jupiter, Earth, and the Sun are directly aligned. Well, that alignment lasts for possibly up to a month in terms of electrical plasma connections that can drive our weather systems. And so what happens? On the 28th, we were also hit with a tremendous solar flare that came from a sunspot that left the sun on around the 23rd, and that was a series of solar events resulting from a comet hitting the sun, and discharging the sun, not necessarily hitting the sun, causing the flare, but it, as that comet comes in, snap, it's like a spark plug in a car that discharges the solar capacitor locally, drives energy into that solar surface, and ignites solar flaring. That solar flaring comes out and eventually 3-4 days later starts affecting Earth weather. The solar models of the National Weather Service include absolutely none of this. So how can they possibly predict the weather? A couple topics here. Oh, this is for a mail order. I just want to mention somebody sent in a mail order for the 2-CD set. Troy from St. Paul, and we don't have an address. Apparently, it was on a check or something. So if you're Troy from St. Paul, please send us your address so we can send you the 2-CD set. That happens very rarely, but by the way, you are listening to WWCR right now on our wintertime frequency of 5070. And that's a very good, powerful signal that works well in the winter time. So hopefully you have seen this. If you have friends that have not been able to listen this week, they might be tuning into the old summertime frequency. We're on 5070 right now, WWCR. And by the way, that does not affect the weekend, Friday night or Saturday morning airings of this show. Let's see, what else am I going to talk about here? Oh, here's a kind of an interesting story that crossed my desk, and something I personally have experience with. Now, when you go to the, just a second. Okay, this is something I have a experience with. In the airport now, if you go through a security check in the airport, you go into the line where they take your shoes off and you put your bag on the thing and it goes through the X-ray machine and all of that. Before you get there, you have to give your ID and ticket to a guy sitting at a counter. Well, and they look at you and they say, where are you going? And they might ask you a couple of questions. Well, now there's another guy, a uniformed or woman, uniformed TSA person, Transportation Safety Administration, and they start to chit-chat with you. You know, hi, how's it going? You having a good day? Oh, doggone, it's good to see you, you know, at the old airport here. What they're doing, it's called a spot check. And let me see if I have this right here. It's screening passengers by optical techniques, it's called. So they're looking at to see if you're nervous, if you have any animosity towards this guy that's trying to chit-chat with you. And if you do, if they detect one of their signs, you're fumbling with your hands or whatever they are looking for, then as you go through the line, they have a way of signaling to the people that you're the one that should be observed or checked out. So at any rate, this is something that you're going to encounter. And I actually recently went through an airport where I was subject to that. And it was kind of like, to me, it was pretty weird. Because here's this guy, and, you know, he's in uniform, and it's not like I really want to talk to him. I just am, you know, there about my own business. But they start to chit-chat with you. Like, oh, isn't it sunny out today? It's like, you know, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to talk to anybody. If there's somebody here that I know and I want to talk to, I'll talk to them. But, you know, I don't want to talk to you, buddy. And so anyway, you're supposed to be nice to these people, and so that you don't look like a hardened criminal that's going to blow up the world. Anyway, just giving you a little heads up on that. Also, I've noticed the disinformation sources. Now, we had Comet Ellen, and that's gone, come and gone. It took a lot of my time, but in that time that I wasted dealing with that ridiculous issue, a lot of people got educated that, you know, this isn't just a bunch of goofy people out there. This is a well-orchestrated disinformation campaign with a point to it, to distract people. But what I'm noticing now, there were what appeared to be some legitimate sources of information out there that had a distribution of information. I thought, well, gee, this sounds pretty, you know, like the person might be somewhat reasonable. Some of those recently have changed to come out with really goofy, like 2012 Planet X is going to be here, Nibiru is coming, it's going to crash into Earth, that NASA knows about this and they're not telling us, and that all kinds of other true misinformation tactics and programs are being inserted into these what appeared to be before legitimate, semi-legitimate. I wouldn't call anybody really legitimate on the internet today. There's too many quacks and goofballs out there. But all of a sudden, many of these are turning for the worst. And in other words, they're throwing a lot of really goofy misinformation into what before seemed to be normal information. But see, that's the hook. That's the trick. You can't catch fish unless you have good bait. And that's true in the misinformation world. You have to give out, if you're in the misinformation world and you're, say, a guy's got a PhD in disinformation, managing crowd information or managing population control, they know that they have to give out some amount of good information, and then they can throw the twist, the 90-degree turn in there later. But at any rate, I'm noticing that. Just another little notice here. The other day, I don't eat much meat anymore, especially meat that comes from the store, but I happened to be where some people were cooking, and they had some beef that was, they were making it into a soup. And I remember the old commercial. There used to be a little old lady, and it was one of the hamburger chains. And the phrase that they always used was, "Where's the beef?" And they showed a hamburger, and you take off this big bun, and there's a little teeny piece of beef in there. So the expression was, "Where's the beef?" And now what happens is you get a nice big, you know, good-looking piece of beef at the store, and you take it home to cook it, and the beef reduces down to about half that size. And literally, these people that I was with, they were cooking, they measured the amount of water there was by volume, more water than beef. And so, anyway, that just, you know, you raise the question, now where's the beef? But, you know, it's bad for beef growers, because what does that do? That tells people, I'm not going to buy beef anymore, because it's just, you're just paying a very high price for water. Let me see. I talked about the Jupiter winds, and here's a story. The debris from China, the tsunami of the Chinese March 11th tsunami in China, is now covering about one-third of the Pacific Ocean. They figure it will be arriving in the Hawaiian Islands within a bit over a year, and it will be arriving in the California coast in mass in about another year after that. So I don't know, they say it's moving much faster than anticipated, but they showed fields of this debris out in the middle of the ocean. Then this is added to the plastic fields that are already floating out there. It's just phenomenal. And it looks like, from what I could see, most of the debris had plastic in it. So, but this is, as I said, it's a cloud I'm sure you can go on the internet and search and see an analysis of the Pacific Ocean to show where the Japanese tsunami rubbish is what came off in the tsunami moving easterly, and it'll continue to wash up on the Hawaiian Islands and the west coast of the United States and all the west coasts of the Americas for years to come. China yesterday had a space first for China. They had an unmanned supply vehicle dock with their space station. This was a huge step. I can't tell you how huge this is. Docking is one of the most difficult maneuvers in space. And, of course, China went out. They didn't do anything for 20 years in the space program. They went out and simply bought Russian technology when Russia was at a low ebb, needed cash to fuel their space program. They simply sold China their designs, and this includes the maneuvering technology, the computer programs, everything it takes to dock, one of the most difficult things to develop. China just went out and bought it. So now China is able to dock unmanned. This is extremely important. They can send a spacecraft up there. The spacecraft can get together, dock, and this is an amazing feat. The United States accomplished this back in the Gemini program. That was the whole purpose of the Gemini program. That was the pre-Apollo program in the United States space program. The first manned space program in the United States was the Mercury program with a single man in a capsule. Then there was the Gemini program that had two men in a capsule, and then they sent up multiple capsules to understand how to dock those, how to bring the nose of one to the nose of the other. And then, of course, the Apollo program required all kinds of docking techniques. But the Chinese now are able to do that. They have a space station in space, and they're on their way. At a time when the United States is basically, we have a massive amount of money going into our space program and nothing going on. The shuttle fleet is down. It will be decades before the U.S. has any kind of rocket capability. So basically, we have lost big time the space race. While still billions and billions of dollars every year get poured into NASA, that's an agency that has to be shut down, but is Congress-proof. Like many things in the United States, we're wallowing in a rut and can't get out. I'm going to quick mention this. I like to keep up with what readers are sending in. One listener sent in a little item where somebody is preaching that the Earth is the center of the universe, saying that nobody has ever proven that the universe is out there and we're somehow moving around the sun. In other words, the geocentric, the Earth-centered concept versus the heliocentric, the Earth moving around the sun. And the person is saying, or the quote is saying, that somebody is promoting that Galileo was wrong, the Earth does not move around the sun, and there's no physical evidence to suggest that. Well, if you simply stand on Earth, and one of the things they quote, by the way, is that you don't feel any force when you're on the surface of the Earth. Well, it's really not true. Because let's take, for example, when we launch satellites, this is a great example. You can launch a satellite from near the equator, and you get a 1,000-mile-per-hour boost. It takes a lot less rocket fuel to launch a satellite from the equator or nearer the equator. That's why the U.S. space program launches from Florida. They would launch from Hawaii, but it's just so distant, it's hard to get things there, equipment. So, in fact, there was a big push at one point to put a spaceport in Hawaii. But now they keep it in the United States in Florida, but that's Florida's the southernmost part of the U.S. France and Europe have their launch station in Guyana, down in South America. that's where they launch from, because you get a 1,000 mile per hour boost for free simply because the Earth is turning. That's one great example of the Earth showing how the Earth turns. If you launch from the North Pole, you miss out on that 1,000 mile per hour velocity. The Earth is 25,000 miles in diameter. It rotates at a rate of about once every 24 hours, so that gives you the 1,000 miles per hour. Another example, there's a bulge in the oceans at the Earth's equator. If the Earth all of a sudden stopped rotating, that bulge in the Earth's ocean would spread out. It would change the ocean levels around the planet. The ocean levels would rise up at the northern and southern latitudes, and it would go down at the equator. So you can actually measure this. It's a measurable quantity. So we do rotate. And so since we rotate, that tells you that as we see the stars and the planets and the sun coming over us, they're not rotating around us. We are rotating so that we see that. Now, also in there are physical principles. We've sent satellites out in front of Earth and behind Earth and all different places around Earth. And they would simply fall to the sun if the Earth were the center of the universe. These would simply fall towards the sun. The dynamics, the physics of rotational dynamics, celestial mechanics, is well understood. So, yes, there is proof that the Earth is rotating. Another good example is if you understand how physics works, when somebody is in a satellite, a manned satellite, they're gravitationless. They are weightless. Even though they're moving in a circle around the gravitational well of Earth. That's because centrifugal force of them going in a circle opposes the gravitational force, offsetting to give you a force of zero. So that's why you feel no force. It's not because there is no force, it is because you have two forces, centrifugal force versus gravitational force. They are equal and opposite, and therefore they balance out to be zero. So these are basic physical principles. Anyway, that's just a response to a listener writing in. I like to include listener comments and questions because lots of people out there possibly are thinking the same thing. Before I get too much farther, I want to do a product study or product review of the items that I have for sale on the web page. And for many, many, many weeks, I have not done any discussion of products or whatever. But every now and then, now is a good time. People are thinking about the holidays and what to get people. The items on my webpage are there for a reason. They're essential items. And they're very well priced, I should say that. I should mention, too, that any of these items, when you order, you can specify to have them shipped to someone at a different address. That's in the ordering system. So you can go to the ordering system, and you can also order by mail and specify that we send it to someone else. But the vast majority of ordering, I believe, these days is done on the Internet, on the webpage, JMCC. S is in Sam, C is in Charlie, I is in Indigo.com. So very quickly, I'm going to go through the items that are available on the webpage. And as I say, these are things that people need in their lives. They're not just frivolous items. So first I'm going to start with the freeze-dried food. I'm reposting some of these. We now have diced, in terms of meat, these are all number 10 canned Mountain House freeze-dried food, the good stuff. Diced beef, diced chicken, ground beef. We have pretty good supply of meat, something we didn't have for a long time. Scrambled eggs and bacon, garden green peas, corn, and in terms of meals, rice and chicken, chicken a la king, and some other ones. But those are all cases 6 cans in a case, number 10 cans, Mountain House freeze-dried food, the good stuff. And so that's available there. Looking at the flax, that's something that I really want people to be aware of. Flax is the biblical historical survival food. They said if you had flax, you were a person that was a survivor. You can live on flax. It has pretty much everything you need to live. If I were going to run out the door in a survival situation, I would grab two things. I would take my Dalton water filter off the counter. I'd pour all the water out of it because water is too heavy to carry around. And I would tuck that under one arm, and I'd probably grab a gallon or two or a case of 4 gallons of flaxseed. If I could get something else along with me in my car or on my bicycle or walking, whatever I was doing, I would take flax first. That would be the absolute first thing I would take. You can plant it. It'll grow into flax in the seed. You can grow it at just about any place. Flax is something that you have to grind it a little bit. You could smash it with a rock if you had to, but you have to break that shell, and that's why flax is so such an amazing item. It can freeze, it can thaw, it can get hot, but that protective shell is going to keep it for a very long time. So the cases of flax seed, 4 gallons in a case, $140, and if you were in a survival situation, I would say have 2 cases of flax per person per year as your basic survival food. You could live on that. It's nice to have other stuff, but that would get you through. I do have the clean canteens. They come in 6 packs. I only sell them 6 at a time. In the 18-ounce, the 27-ounce, and the big 40-ounce size. The 40-ounce is bigger than it's like a quart and a quarter. Clean canteens, stainless steel canteens to go along with your water system. Okay, then I want to make sure everybody gets the new 2-CD set. It's $16.95 for one set of 2 CDs. This is 18 hours of lectures dealing with survival and Planet X issues. 18 hours of lectures on this 2-CD set. One set is $16.95. That includes shipping. The CD itself, the 2-CD set, is $11.95. But then we add in the shipping there. If you buy 2 sets of the CD at one time, you get free shipping, and that's $23.95. Plus, I've got all the books there. The Planet X, Comet, and Earth Changes book is going now into its 9th printing and still selling as well as when it was originally announced. Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, The Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, The Weather Book, Calculate Primes, and The Diamond Principle, all 6 of the books are there. Great presents if you have students, if you have grandmothers, if you have people that like to read and understand what's going on in the world. And then there's the one of my favorites is the 110 high-resolution pictures of the American Southwest. It's on a CD. It's available, and you can zoom in. You can see the entire American Southwest on these 110 pictures. Just an amazing set of pictures taken from high altitude. Excuse me. Then we have the DVD sets. DVD number 1 and 2 come in a set. And that is 8 or 9 historical videos of my lectures, starting way back in the 1980s and carrying up to now. You'll see me as a much younger person, but also talking about my science that I developed. And then there's the DVD number 3, which is the first of 20 DVD series. It's the first of the 20 DVD series lectures. Okay, and then just quickly, the pre-filter is something that fits onto every standard gravity water filter, any make, model, it'll fit, and it's something you need to, if you have oil or grease or radioactivity, whatever you have in your water, this is meant to take out a good portion of that before it goes into your water filter. It's for emergency. Some people I know are using it all the time because they live in a situation where they have, say, a tremendous amount of sulfur in their water. They use the pre-filter to get a lot of that out of there before they get, the water goes into their nice, clean stainless steel water container or plastic water container, whatever the case. And then there's the Dalton water filters, the stainless steel standard Dalton water filter, something everybody should have. I take mine on trips with me, and I'm constantly asked. People say, what do you do for water here? And I show them my water filter. And they say, well, how much does that weigh? I say, well, just a couple pounds. It's very light. You know, you can stuff clothes in it, so it doesn't really take up that much room. And you get to any place, you have your own water supply. And then I have one or a couple of the Clean Canteen stainless steel water bottles. I have my own traveling water supply, and that same stainless steel water filter is in my kitchen. It's the most used thing in my house. Then there's the high-capacity, high-density polyethylene plastic water filter, and it will filter up to 50 gallons per day. It comes with five of the Super Stericell Dalton water filter elements. Just the filter elements alone would cost more than what you pay for this entire water filter unit. So it's a tremendous value. There's the personal travel emergency water filter, 1 liter size. It has one Dalton filter element in it. And then not to mention the replacement filter elements. You get four replacement filter elements for $140. It's just something that you need on hand. And then the fluoride arsenic filters. I've been promoting people to get the fluoride arsenic filters, even if they don't use them, if they're not on city water. Arsenic is one of the most common poisonous chemicals in water, whether you're on well water or city water. It's in just about all the water supplies of the United States. Okay, enough of that. Just this is a time that to start ordering for, like I say, you can have these items shipped any place in the world to someone else. You can order and have them shipped to someone or shipped to you, and then you distribute them yourself. So tremendous variety of very important items there. And it also helps promote this show and keep it rolling, etc. So anyway, as I said, usually I don't have commercials, and I was a little bit long-winded on this, so I apologize. But now is the time to, a lot of people are thinking about what to buy for the holidays, for presents or whatever. Okay, enough of that. The jet streams, I want to talk a little bit about that, and I'm going to start this out with a little story I just saw on England. There's a private company, apparently, that's been providing information to the government of England, and they're stating that England is going to have a horrendous December, where the temperatures are going to plummet, they're going to have sub-zero temperatures. And they're trying to send out messages to the people so that they reduce the number of deaths in England. So I want to pull up this web page if I can find it here. My computer screen is kind of full of it's very busy with. But anyway, I'll keep talking while I'm looking for the article. Oh, here it is. Okay. Nope, that's the one about Mars. Okay. Anyway, the story was that England is going to have a tremendous winter this year, and they're trying to prevent 25,000 deaths in England due to the severe winter. But they give all kinds of explanations of what I call standard science, like, well, there's a high-level, high-pressure system to the east of England that's blocking the flow of air, so that's maintaining warmer air in England. That's why it's been warm. And then, all of a sudden, if that moves, that's going to plunge England into a deep freeze. Never, never, never does it mention that the traditional English warming current is the ocean current that came up from the Gulf of Mexico. And here's how that worked before the BP oil spill. So I find it interesting that they're trying to predict that England is going to have severe weather, but then they blame it on that high pressure cell over there. Ridiculous, ridiculous, meaningless science. And so this is something I think is going to become more common as time goes on. Ridiculous science giving excuses for what poor corporate management is doing over here, or governments can't control. It's the government, it's like the government's trying to save the people, trying to do everything they can, when in fact, England should have been the first one down to the Gulf of Mexico screaming that you gotta stop this oil spill and clean it up, because it's gonna wreck the ocean streams that provide warmth to England. But they can get someone, a non-government source, to provide, or try and provide, basically bad science to convince the people that this is just an act of God and there's nothing we can do about it. But that storm leads into the main science topic, jet streams. I talked about the northeastern storms being caused by the Jupiter winds, and if you missed the October 20th show, the Jupiter winds I defined as when we become aligned with Jupiter. That's a Jupiter-Earth-Sun electrical alignment. This is not a gravitational alignment, because the electrical size of the planets is much larger than the physical size. It's millions of times larger. And so when the electric discharge of the solar capacitor of Jupiter and Earth align, they connect, and that extends what used to be a relatively short electrical discharge in both of them. That connects the two together, and we get some driving Earth weather. And so that is what I call the Jupiter winds, the winds on Earth that are caused by the connection, the electrical connection with Jupiter. For more detail, listen to my October 20th show. And then we had the tremendous northeastern storm that the National Weather Service not only could not explain or predict, but they could not explain it. So I want to talk more about jet streams. Now, what are jet streams? They about 30 to 100,000 feet high in the atmosphere. It's the layer between the weather layer of Earth, the troposphere, and the stratosphere, which is just above it. And if you look up for the standard explanations of what causes the jet streams, it's really pretty hand-waving. When we used to be in college, and we had a professor, we'd get into some difficult topics, for example, and the professor just didn't quite have all the answers. We called, and you'd ask them a tough question, and they'd start to dance around the question, or this or that. We called that hand waving. It was a way of them trying to talk around the topic. And so we didn't have much mercy on professors that did that. But at any rate, the standard explanation goes something like this. Now, this is not my explanation. This is standard science explanation. They say that, well, there's a warm layer here, that's the troposphere, above that is a cooler layer. And so that junction between those warm and cool layer, there's a some kind of a motion that occurs because one's hot, one's cold. Well, gee, that kind of makes sense. But wait, these are vertical temperature differences. That would tend to tell me that there should be some kind of vertical movement possibly, but not horizontal. But that's just kind of hand-waving. It's just like, well, yeah, it kind of gets it moving horizontally, too. But the reality is you have a jet stream running a few hundred miles per hour moving around the Earth. How does this form? And then this, in turn, drives the lower weather systems of the Earth. How does this happen? How can you get a heat and cold air mass to cause a jet stream to move through it at hundreds of miles per hour? Well, the standard explanation, like all of standard science, is fairy tale science. It doesn't work. They can't explain where the jet streams come from. They can't explain how the energy that comes in from the sun, in terms of light energy, how does that get driven up into the above the troposphere and then collimated into these narrow bands of wind that circle the Earth? Well, it doesn't make any sense at all. Something else has to be going on. And here's something I like to do. It's kind of a thought experiment. What if you took their explanation for whatever is driving the jet streams, and you took a snapshot of it, and you said, okay, here's the jet stream, it's moving at this velocity, let's let it go in the weather system. What would happen to that jet stream, left all by itself, given the weather conditions, given the solar input? And now remember that this is on the night side of Earth, too. These jet streams are moving around. And it doesn't seem to bother it that it's on the daytime or the nighttime, or it doesn't seem to matter if they come across the terminator line between day and nighttime. The jet streams keep going. So what exactly is going on? The thing I like to do to, and I can also do this, say, with the hurricane argument that hurricanes come from warm water. What would happen if you took a hurricane over a warm body of water and said, okay, here's a snapshot of it right now. Here's the wind velocities out in the arms. Here's the wind velocity in the eye. Let's just let this thing sit there and see what it does. It would dissipate. How fast would it dissipate? Oh, within a couple hours. And for certain, the winds would dissipate very quickly. How can you get a warm ocean that's just a big flat body of water to drive energy up and cause circular motion in a central eye and cause these tremendous updrafts in the central eye, and 150-mile-an-hour winds where the winds are coming in and pouring into that center region like a huge vacuum with a low pressure at the center? How does this thing maintain itself over, because there's a warm body of water under it? It is so absurd, it defies imagination, because if you just left that hurricane go on its own, it would dissipate. You need a very powerful energy source to keep that hurricane powered up and moving. And that energy source has to come from outside the zone where the hurricane is. So at any rate, let's go back to the jet stream. This case is exactly the same. Take a jet stream. It's 30,000 or 50,000 feet up in the atmosphere above the Earth's surface. It's about 40 or 50 miles wide, and it's a 200 mile an hour moving stream of gas, of air. What keeps that thing moving? Things don't just happen on their own. It's like the northeast. Oh, this. I just want to jump back to the northeast storm. Tremendous snowstorm that hit the northeast, crippling it, taking out power for millions and millions of people. When I looked, and I was trying to always try and find what the official story is, what the cause was, what does the National Weather Service say, what do they say is the main cause of that storm? Here is their explanation. It was a rare fall or autumn storm. Now, let me see. Nowhere in that explanation does it talk about energy. Storms don't happen just because it's fall. Storms happen all year long. They could happen in February. They could happen in June. They could happen in August. They could happen any month or day of the year. So to say that it is a rare autumn storm is about as unscientific as saying that the price of baking powder went up and therefore we had a storm. It has absolutely nothing. A rare autumn storm was the official explanation. Absolutely no scientific understanding in that at all. Storms require energy. Energy systems that bring in cold air from the north that bring in moisture. These factors combine for a reason. It's not because it's autumn. The jet streams do not simply move around because they happen to be between a cold and warm layer. It's absolutely fairy tale science. So what causes the jet streams to move around the way they do? We have two in the northern hemisphere, we have two in the southern hemisphere, and they kind of snake around. They go north, they go south, they go east, but generally they're moving in an easterly direction. They come from the west and they move to the east. Around the equator is a jet stream that moves westerly. It goes from the east to the west. I guess in terms of meteorology, they would say that was an easterly jet stream, but it meaning that it comes from the east and goes west. I never quite agreed with that terminology, but that's standard meteorology terminology. So at any rate, we have a jet stream that moves to the west, and gee, guess what happens? The hurricanes ride underneath that jet stream. That jet stream happens to be made up primarily of electrons. And when we have lightning in the equator, typically it's different than lightning that we have in the northern and southern hemispheres. So the systems are driving, the jet streams are driving the lower weather weather systems. And so what causes, you can't have the reverse happen where the lower weather systems are then driving the jet streams. It doesn't work that way. Where's the magic here? You can't have something driving a weather system down here and then that drives the jet stream. It doesn't work. There's some kind of voodoo science involved in that type of explanation. So what's really going on, the jet streams that move in the easterly direction are positively charged. They're moving because they're coupled to the Earth's magnetic field. They are literally electrical currents flowing in our atmosphere. They're coupled to other magnetic fields that are up higher in the ionosphere. They're coupled to the Van Allen belts, which are in turn coupled to the overall geomagnetic field, that the plasma magnetic field of electrical currents that swirl around Earth and that are also driven as the solar wind comes out. The solar wind comes out from the sun, made up of positive and negative charges. When it hits our magnetic field, that splits the positive charge particles in one direction. It splits the electrons and other negative ions in another direction, and they go in different directions and wrap around the Earth, just like your hands wrapping around a globe that's in front of you. And that charge differential causes some electrical conditions to happen inside of that. So you have magnetic conditions, you have electrical conditions, and they're dynamic, they're moving, they compress, they expand. Based on other conditions in outer space and the solar wind, basically those magnetic fields work their way down and drive the jet streams, the positive charged northern and southern hemisphere jet streams going easterly in an east direction, I should say, and the central equatorial jet stream moving west from east to west. And those are coupled. Those are magnetic, electrically coupled systems. Now, why in standard science do they really not want to talk about that? Well, most standard scientists never question it because, well, that's what they learned. If they had to take a test, they put that answer on the test and they got an A, so it must be right. That's what it says in the textbook, so it must be right. And so they go on to get a PhD in fairy tale science. It can't possibly be true. It doesn't make any sense at all. And on a very cursory scientific analysis, it breaks down. A third grader can understand that it doesn't make sense. Okay, so at any rate, what causes the jet streams? If the jet streams, as I'm saying, are powered from outside, now you have a source of power that can be transferred down to the troposphere, to the Earth weather systems down at the surface of the Earth and near the surface of the Earth. As the jet stream, let's look at the northern hemisphere. The jet streams are moving like a snake, moving east, and as the jet stream swings down south and then swings back north, in that cusp where it swings down, goes east, and then swings back up, in that cusp of the jet stream are the typically the low cells. And as the jet stream swings up and then goes easterly and then swings back south again, in that cusp are typically the high cells. And these can move up, they can move down, and but basically that jet stream is wrapping around the high and low cells. Well, what's a high cell? What's a low cell? These are also powered by electrical conditions from above. There's pressure that comes down all the way from the upper atmosphere to create those low and high conditions. They're swirling, which causes weather patterns. It causes wind patterns. And that's why when you see, for example, what I call a himacane, that's a cell, a system or weather cell that's caught in the cusp of one of those jet streams, and that the center of that weather system is connected electrically up to the ionosphere and causes a column of air to move upwards, and that causes a low pressure cell at the bottom, and that causes the storm to spin in a counterclockwise direction. All of this is understandable from an electrical magnetic point of view. It's all very understandable. But as I said, none of this, absolutely none of it, do you find in any of the National Weather Service models. They're doing voodoo science. They're talking about, well, there's a high pressure cell up here that's holding this air back, and that's why England is warm. Has absolutely nothing to do with reality. I have one more story I wanted to talk about, and it's really fairly important. NASA has put out a study regarding Mars, and they're saying that if Mars had life on it at one time in the past, then it had to be underground, basically, that the science, conditions on Mars indicate that any life that may have been there was underground. And then they go on to say that the water on Mars, of which there is ample evidence of water on the surface of Mars, they're saying that the water came and went. They don't really say how the water magically came and then magically went all of a sudden. They don't even say that, but it was millions of years ago, so we really don't have to think or worry about that. They put it out millions of years ago. They claim that they looked at clay deposits and other geological data, but the point is that they do not allow for the fact, the very clear concept, that water or the atmospheric and water environments, the liquid water or the other, whether it's oil, whether it's hydrocarbons, whether it's methane, whether it's oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen, whether it's water, no matter what the environmental conditions on a planet, those things have changed many times in the past. Well, how do they change? It's not because the planet just jumped up and did it by itself one day. These magical things don't happen. Like with weather, as with weather, there are causes. There are effects. And unless you can identify those causes and effects, you don't have a theory. You don't have an explanation. Just saying that it happened millions of years ago and then not giving any reason for why it happened or why it came and went, that isn't science. That's just putting it out of sight, out of mind. So how do planets change their environments? Well, the real thing that happens, and the thing that we know happened with Mars, was observed. The ancients observed Mars to be a water planet, just like Earth. And the in a night of disaster, the comet Venus that had been trapped by Jupiter, the comet Venus that was working its way into the solar system eventually to become the planet Venus, the steaming hot planet that we see today, which still has a comet tail, by the way, that as that comet passed Mars, the ancients saw in a single night it extracted the oceans and atmospheres from Mars, leaving it to be the red hulk of a planet that we see today. And just a good example, there are riverbeds, pristine, very meandering riverbeds on Mars. There are all kinds of water geological features on the surface of Mars. If the water conditions that NASA claims were there millions of years ago, but then have not been there for millions of years, excuse me, if that were true, then those pristine traces, those riverbeds, would be destroyed because every year Mars has tremendous dust storms. And so the conditions we see on Mars are very different than they were in the past, just like conditions on Earth were very different from what they were in the past. The atmospheres change dramatically. When the ancients talk about the influx of naphtha and burning rocks, that fire and brimstone that came in from above, the ancients talk about this. This stuff came in from above. The Noah flood came from above. It rained for 40 days and 40 nights, torrential rain all over the planet. This came from outside. How did this happen? Well, Earth was passing through the tail of a very large comet. Not the little poofy comets we see today, not like Halley's Comet, not even like Hale-Bopp, which was a medium-sized comet. At any rate, the atmosphere on Mars and probably all the planets has changed dramatically with time. I'm running into my last about 50 seconds of the show. Just want to remind you, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. Tell your friends to go there. And this just helps. I've got two books that are in reprint right now. That'll help out with the reprinting costs and also keeps the webpage, keeps the radio program. And so, you get something very valuable for the exchange of some very worthless money. So, with that in mind, this is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.